Hi, Alex.
Hey, Adam.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to Liver Talks. We are part of the Liver Fellow Network, and this is episode 2 of season 2, a little bit late.
Yep.
So we apologize for that.
We do. And we thank you all for listening to episode 1 of season 2. There were some scheduling snafus, but we have 3 incredible guests lined up right now and locked in. So you can expect 1 episode a month for at least the next 3 months, but hopefully during that time we can line up some further guests as well.
Unless there are more snafus, which is always possible.
It is. We have very little pull, so snafus abound.
Yes. So why don't you tell everyone about our guest today and what you guys talked about?
It was a solo interview because Adam was literally saving lives today. And so I had an awesome conversation with Dr. Lauren Nephew from Indiana University talking about all things disparities in liver transplantation. I learned a ton from the conversation, and I hope everybody enjoys it. If there are other people that you think we should be talking to within this space, we would love any recommendations our listenership has, so please let us know.
Great. All right. Well, let's take a listen to it.
We are thrilled to have Dr. Lauren Nephew on the podcast today. Dr. Nephew is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Nephew, thank you so much for being on the pod today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we thought we might just start with asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, your practice, and your research interests.
Sure. I'm a Midwesterner. I was born in Cleveland and raised in Cincinnati. I went to med school at Case Western. I did the Cleveland Clinic track, which was a new track at the time for people who were interested in being physician scientists. So it's a 5-year program where you do 4 years of med school and kind of a year of research and 2 summers of research in between. So it was kind of a novel program, and now it's taken off. So I did that for med school. And then I did residency at Mass General in Boston, and I did fellowships in GI and hepatology at the University of Pennsylvania. While I was at Penn, I got a master's in epidemiology. And while I was at Case, backing up, I got a master's in ethics because I kind of had an interest in health equity and justice and those topics and how to frame disparities in a kind of ethics lens. And so I thought, you know, as a medical student, it sounded like an interesting thing to do. And so I started on at faculty in 2017 at Indiana University. So I'm fairly junior faculty, came back to the Midwest, closer to family after being on the East Coast for a long time. And here I have a fairly kind of mixed practice. I wear a number of different hats. I am about 70% research, 30% clinical. I do transplant hepatology and general hepatology, and I do a little endoscopy. And I also, we have a primary liver service. And so I cover the primary liver service 6 weeks a year. So I have a nice kind of mix, which is, you know, the great part of GI that you get to do some research, some endoscopy, some transplant, some gen hep, you know.
Well, I think you have the most degrees, or at least the most master's degrees of any of our guests so far.
I am highly overeducated, probably.
The bulk of our conversation, we would at least like to start by talking about your recent excellent review article, along with Dr. Marina Serper from Penn, in Liver Transplantation, which was titled Racial, Gender, and Socioeconomic Disparities in Liver Transplantation. And a useful framework that you use in the paper to identify different disparities in liver transplantation is breaking them into referral, waitlisting practices, allocation, and post-liver transplant care. Could you share a few of your thoughts about which disparities that you guys identified cut across these different phases and which ones are unique?
Sure. I think, you know, we had a lot of discussion, Marina and I, about how we would talk about so much in one paper, because there's, you know, there's different kind of groups that we want, vulnerable populations we want to focus on. And we couldn't decide if we would group all the disparities, you know, by race together, and then all the disparities by gender together, and then all the disparities by socioeconomic status together. And then we thought we really wanted to highlight the care continuum and the cascade, and really highlight how multiple vulnerable populations were disadvantaged at each step. Rather than kind of grouping it by the vulnerable population, we focus on the cascade. And then it highlights, as you've kind of asked in your question, how multiple groups can fall into kind of and have disparities in each step. And so I think some of the biggest disparities now that continue are really kind of early in the care cascade, early in referral and the evaluation process. That's where we see disparities by race, by socioeconomic status, potentially by gender. Some of the data there is mixed. There's less disparity in allocation and how livers are kind of, you know, once people get listed, and some of that was mitigated by the MELD score, but there's certainly gender disparities that persist despite the MELD score. And then there's post-transplant disparities that seem to be largely racial, predominantly in Black populations, but there's been less real study of kind of socioeconomic disparities post-transplant, so probably some more work to be done there. I think there's disparities across the continuum, but a lot of disparities for vulnerable populations are early in that referral and evaluation process.
It's interesting. And one of the interesting things that is brought up in the review and affects a number of these different areas, but certainly the early part, is how policy can either advertently or inadvertently sort of feed into or cause these disparities. We've certainly seen this in other aspects of society, especially surrounding things like housing policy and how that can really exacerbate disparities. But in this case, you raise the example of sort of different states choosing whether or not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act and how that's really fed into a lot of these different disparities. Are there other sort of policies that seem to really be driving disparities? Because one could potentially think of these as particularly fruitful targets for sort of trying to come up with solutions to some of these disparities.
Certainly, I think policy in terms of kind of national and state policy, as well as allocation policies, can impact disparities in transplant access. And certainly allocation policies can impact allocation. Medicaid and Affordable Care Act is a good example. Our group looked at how Medicaid expansion was impacting waitlisting, and it certainly appears that Black patients with hepatitis C were being waitlisted less. And some may think of that as a bad thing, but actually our hypothesis is that people are being treated for hepatitis C. Black patients are getting kind of access to hepatitis C, and that may be driving that downtrend in waitlisting. That may actually be a good thing. Hispanic patients were being waitlisted more, which suggests that access or barriers to access around insurance were perhaps a large barrier to getting to transplant for this group. So I think Medicaid is a good example, or the Affordable Care Act, I should say, is a good example of where kind of high level policy changes can impact allocation. In Indiana, we started looking at some data at about how changes in access to DAAs in terms of Medicaid and even beyond Medicaid or within Medicaid, I should say, how they changed the rules about fibrosis and expanded Medicaid or DAA treatment to patients who had less fibrosis or really got rid of the fibrosis requirement. And that really changed the landscape for treatment of hepatitis C in the state of Indiana. It really has led to what looks to be some improvements in disparity. So there's, you know, kind of small kind of interstate changes that can really impact kind of chronic liver disease disparities. They're kind of large national policies that can impact disparities. And then I think there's allocation policies. I'm very interested to see where the acute alcoholic or alcohol-associated hepatitis policies that are popping up around the country. And how those policies are going to impact minoritized groups So I'm interested to see where that lies. Right now, some of the consortium data suggests that it's mostly white males who are really accessing transplant for acute alcohol hepatitis. And so I'm interested to see how we can kind of how these policies can be tailored to be more open and allow for more diverse groups who may need to access transplant in that setting. So I think there's certainly allocation and national policy can impact disparities positively. And then we can think about allocation policies that have impacted disparities negatively. Perhaps the meld allocation system for women has not been so good.
Right.
And so it certainly seems that the meld allocation system improved waitlist disparities and access to transplant for Black patients waitlisted. But for women, women are largely underserved due to lower muscle mass and lower creatinine, lack of exception points for ACC, smaller stature, and organ offers being declined in that setting. So I think national as well as allocation policies have a large impact on disparities, and it's really prudent that we be careful about how we change those policies. I'm also interested to see the data that comes out over the coming years about the 6 months wait for HCC. We know that Black patients present with larger tumors, more advanced tumors. That's been shown in a number of studies and even in meta-analysis. And so I'm interested to see what the 6 month wait time is going to do over the coming years for that population.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things that you also bring up in the paper that I hadn't necessarily even thought of was that we don't know what we don't know. And particularly in end-stage liver disease and to some extent liver transplantation as well, there's a real issue with actually scoping the problem and understanding what the current disparities even are. And so I'm curious as... You know, the first step in coming up with solutions is actually know what you're trying to solve. And so are there specific questions that you think are most impactful to try to answer so that we really have a handle as to what the current disparities are?
Yeah, you know, I'm so envious of our nephrology colleagues because they have just real data on the problem, right? They know everybody who has end-stage renal disease who is at least requiring dialysis. You know, they have a really solid denominator. And unfortunately, we just don't have that in end-stage liver disease. We know that about 8 to 9% of the wait list is composed of Black patients, but we also know that in the United States, the population is probably more like 13%. We also know that the burden of liver disease, especially for hepatitis C and HCC, is likely higher in Black patients. And so they likely should make up more of the wait list. But I think we really need to answer that question. That's one question we need to answer. And it honestly is going to take multi-center prospective kind of cohort studies to really get an idea of, you know, the scope of the problem. And it can't just be academic centers. It's got to be, you know, our safety net hospitals and that largely serve some of our minority populations so that we can really get an accurate estimate of disease prevalence. So I think that's certainly a big kind of epidemiologic problem that I think is important. I think we need more kind of descriptive analysis about referral and evaluation. You know, most of the studies that we highlight in that section of the paper are from 2000 or cohorts from 2002 to 2004 or 2005. Even though that may have been published later than that, most of the cohorts are actually, even some of them pre-meld era. One of the, Bryce and colleagues study that looked at the full state of Pennsylvania is a nice study because it's multi-center. But unfortunately, it's an older study, and it's hard to know how things have changed more recently. So we need really updated data about what's happening now with the process of referral. And then each step in evaluation is complex. And to just say evaluation, what does that mean? Are people having problems with getting approval? Are they having problems with hepatologists when they see them actually starting an evaluation and thinking it's inappropriate? Are they having problems completing an evaluation? Are they getting to committee and getting stopped because they have too many comorbidities? So I think descriptive data is needed there. I think we need to have some action on the disparity for women. At this point, we've described it enough. It's been described extensively by a number of people, Cynthia Boylan, Jen Lai, myself. It's been described. And so I think at this point, we need to start thinking about modeling what allocation changes would look like. And for shorter stature women, potentially looking at that group and modeling what kind of male score changes would look like. So I think we need action there. And I think we need to be thinking about kind of intervention studies post-transplant, kind of multi-level interventions that could reduce post-transplant disparities in outcomes. So I do think there's some descriptive analysis that are still needed in the kind of referral evaluation stage. Yeah. I think we need to really be acting on some of these disparities in the allocation phase for women because they've really been described sufficiently. Mm-hmm. And then we need to be kind of thinking about really kind of multi-level interventions to kind of deal with post-transplant disparities. That would be kind of some of my thoughts about where we might move forward.
Yeah. And shifting towards solutions and not just scoping the problem, although for the trainees listening, and we think most of our audience is probably trainees, you just described a few really interesting areas for them to potentially sort of do studies. And I think some of the descriptive stuff almost needs to be at a very granular level at the institution level. And so it's stuff that actually does work very well for a trainee that's doing sort of a chart review at their institution or set of institutions. So something to think about for anybody that may be listening. But in thinking about solutions to some of these disparities, I think you sort of alluded to a few questions ago, some things that may be working on a local or state basis that could be sort of expanded to a larger audience, including sort of DAA use in Indiana. Have you seen specific solutions that seem to be very effective in eliminating some of these disparities in liver transplant?
Well, you know, eliminating disparities is tough. You know, there's a task force every 10 years that really tries to figure out how can we eliminate disparities. And they're so it's difficult because it takes time and money and a continuous effort. And, you know, it can't be something that folks are just dabbling in if you really want to. And it's OK to dabble. I don't want to say that. But if you're going to work towards elimination, it takes kind of a constant, persistent kind of effort in terms of describing a disparity, trying to figure out where it's happening, developing an intervention, testing the intervention. Well, that's a lot of steps. I think our oncology colleagues have probably been the most successful at really working on racial disparities in colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and really have found kind of multi-level interventions to try to mitigate those disparities. And they usually involve kind of multiple efforts. You know, for colonoscopy screening, it's been mailing out reminders, informing people about fit testing, having patient navigators, making colonoscopy free. For mammography, it's been same day mammography when people come to their appointments, making mammography free, one-on-one education. What we do know about disparities intervention is that usually one thing is not going to be enough, because you really have to try to battle social determinants and socioeconomic disadvantage. You have to battle knowledge, access. And so I think we will probably be able to borrow from some of the work that has been done in oncology to some extent to try to figure out how we can navigate end-stage liver disease and transplant disparities. Some of the larger policy changes that the kidney folks have made as well may be something we want to think about in the liver world. There's been some policy changes in kidney to kind of make your ability to accrue time, not when you start dialysis necessarily, but as soon as your GFR is less than 20, which kind of takes that referral bias out of the picture a bit. In case you get referred late for dialysis. And so thinking about how we can translate some of that into the liver world might be interesting. Do we want to do that for HCC exception points? You know, perhaps when you get a diagnosis of HCC on a CT as opposed to after you list it, You know, because really we want 6 months to see what, if we can understand the disease biology. But if people are being referred late, then their 6 months perhaps is already after they've been diagnosed for, for 5 months. And so, you know, these are things that we probably need to think about as the data, comes out about how different populations are doing with policy changes like that.
And shifting gears a little bit, obviously we've talked a lot about health disparities, and I really appreciate all your insights. This has been an incredibly interesting conversation so far. But beyond just health disparities for patients, there are significant issues within certainly hepatology, gastroenterology, and medicine more broadly, in terms of representation, with very few black and brown hepatologists and gastroenterologists. And before getting to my question, this is a audio medium, but I can't help but noticing that you're wearing a Association of Black Gastroenterologists and Hepatologists shirt, which is a recently founded organization that is working towards my question to some extent, which is, what are the short and long-term strategies that you think would be most effective in increasing the number of black doctors and then hopefully eventually the number of black hepatologists?
I think it's a really, really important question. And it honestly does relate to disparities in care as well, because I think having a diverse workforce has, you know, evidence that that can improve patients' uptake of treatment, patients' compliance, patients' comfort level. So I do think it's related and important. In terms of what can we do to increase the diversity of the hepatology and GI workforce, one, once again, we need to understand the problem. Unfortunately, we don't have great data about what the numbers look like in hepatology. We don't have great data about that. I'm actually a co-author on a white paper describing disparities in the hepatology workforce. And we were really shocked at how little data there is, how little data they've collected by our national organizations about that. So first, we just need to know where we are. and then in terms of improving the workforce, I think we've got to start early. I think pipeline programs are really, really important. The ASLD has a great liver scholars program for residents to try to get them kind of interested and exposed to GI and hepatology, as many of them may not get a chance to rotate on GI or hepatology rotations in residency. But I think we might need to consider starting earlier. I think we need to think about these programs in high school students. I was a part of a high school summer research program for underrepresented minorities when I was an 11th grader, and it was enormously impactful for me. And part of the reason I became a physician scientist, I knew I wanted to be a physician, but after that program, I really became interested in science and the scientific method. And I think catching people early is important. And so I think pipeline programs that go to start a little earlier are going to be important. Working to retain the folks that we have now in academic medicine and is important. And so groups like the Association for Black Gastroenterologists and Hepatologists are important. They create an environment that is welcoming and comfortable. And I think that groups like this that kind of push forward and amplify the voices of gastroenterologists of color are important. Those are some of the main things. I think starting early in the pipeline and then just working on retention of the people that we do have. And mentorship, I would also add, I think is important. Mentorship of the residents, medical students, and fellows by faculty. Mentorship of house staff of color is lacking. GI is one of the most competitive specialties out of internal medicine. And a lot of people are not quite sure how to navigate getting in, when to start research, is research necessary, do I need letters? And so I think people need mentorship and direction early.
Absolutely. And free plug for the Emerging Liver Scholars Program. I think the applications just opened recently. So I highly recommend people apply. Adam was a former Emerging Liver Scholar and is still at least interested in liver. Whether or not he's a scholar is a separate issue. But and so I think that's a great program. But improving and making mentorship earlier and earlier, I think obviously makes a lot of sense. So you've made it to the end of the interview, so thank you. but before you go, this is when we find out if you've ever listened to a previous episode, which is probably no. But we do a quick lightning round with each of our guests for mostly things that don't have to do with liver. So we will begin that, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. So we'll start with a softball. When was the last time you performed a colonoscopy?
About 12 days ago.
All right. That's pretty good. That's not the longest it's been for a guest. Our second question, which we really love, is what's a time that luck played a role in your career?
Recently, I gave a talk at the ASLD meeting that was virtual, and the editor for eClinical Medicine, which is the online journal for The Lancet, for some reason, listened to my talk after the fact. She's not a hepatologist, but she's interested in diversity and equity, and somehow, I don't know how, she stumbled upon our diversity workshop at the ASLD. And she invited me to write a commentary after hearing my talk. And it's been really, it was really a great opportunity for me to kind of write about vaccine hesitancy and social determinants of health and kind of structural racism and topics that kind of meld together my ethics hat and my disparities hat and then current events. And I've done a lot of writing because I had a master's in ethics. So a lot of writing and a lot of writing arguments. And so this was a great opportunity. And so I published a commentary in eClinical Medicine at The Lancet that's gotten some interesting play lately. And some of that was luck. It was just, you know, that she happened to be listening to that. So you never know who's even listening to these online talks that you think, oh my gosh, I wish I had gotten the opportunity to really do a podium talk. It's just going to go on some random website, but somebody listened to it.
I think that may be an example of you making your own luck, but that is still a very good story. So thank you for sharing that. And you can decide any of these categories, but what's the last either book you read or movie or TV show you watched?
I'm going to say TV show because I'm actually not a huge TV watcher, but because of the pandemic, I've been watching more TV. As one must. There's not as much to do these days. So I just finished watching Handmaid's Tale. On, I said Hulu or Netflix? Hulu.
I think
it's
Hulu.
On Hulu right now.
Yep.
And so I just finished the last episode of the third season like a couple of days ago. It is intense.
But I couldn't
stop watching it. Yeah, it's very intense. If I'd known what I was getting into, I don't know if I would have started. but it was intense, and I enjoyed it. And I'm not sure if enjoy is the right word, but it was thought provoking and interesting, and the characters were very well developed, and I'm interested to see season four when it comes out in April.
Well, we'll have you back for a review of season four. And then our last question that we ask everybody is, what is your favorite type of liver cell?
My favorite type of liver cell. I am going to say, I'm just going to say hepatocyte.
All right. That's a safe bet. It's an important one.
It's the most abundant one. You know, I'm going to go with hepatocyte.
I think that's great. If people want to sort of follow you moving forward, is there a best place to do that, either Twitter or otherwise?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm Lauren Nephew MD. Just my name, MD. That's my handle on Twitter. So, follow me. I like to post stuff about liver transplantation and disparities and all that good stuff. So.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Nephew, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Alex, what are you up to this weekend?
That's a great question. What I'm up to on Friday and Saturday, March 26th and 27th, is attending the HCC TAG Conference.
Oh.
Last year in Park City, this year right on your couch. It's all virtual this year. It is completely free. That is free with $0 signs
for
all trainees. And is a conference just about all things HCC, with an emphasis on the multidisciplinary nature of the disease and care. There are debates, there's cutting-edge research, and there is what has been described as boisterous discussions between world experts.
Just like our podcast.
That's right, minus the world experts. Will I see you there?
You'll see me there. You'll HCC see me there.
There we are. All right. So HCC Tag, March 26th and March 27th, free for trainees.
Let's get out of this read.
So thank you again to Dr. Lauren Nephew for that great conversation. I hope you guys all enjoyed it. And Adam, I now recalled that in the first segment, we forgot to wish you a happy birthday, which was this week.
Oh, thank you. It's very sweet. Yes. And I just like to dispel the myth that I was saving lives.
Yes, you actually were, whereas I'm on a research elective. So I got to do the interview, which I'm very happy I got to do, but we missed you dearly.
Oh, thank you.
And you will actually see us next month. There won't be an extreme delay.
Yeah. Yes.
But thank you all for listening. And with that, bye, Adam.
Bye, Alex.
Happy birthday.
Oh.